Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Cosmos Magazine Summer 2018, reading through the articles. So this one, again, is by Elizabeth Finkel, Artifice Imitating Life. When plenty of scientists are working on humanoid robots, Hiroshi Ikoh actually wants to build a human, Elizabeth Finkel reports. At first, they appear to be twins. These two Japanese are clad identically in black, wear the same black rectangular glasses, the same stern expression, and sport the same stylish mop of shiny jet black hair. Looking again, you see one of them is doll-like, a robot. Hiroshi Ishigo is a director of Intelligent Robotics Laboratories, RL, in Osaka University. He's well known for posing with his android twin. It's not just weird, publicity stunt. This might be the answer to Japan's labour crisis. With the greying population, close to 28% of its 127 million people aged over 65, below replacement birth rate, and reluctance to ramp up immigration, Japan needs to make its own workers. It already has plenty of industrial robots. But who will tend the elderly in overflowing nursing homes, and perhaps just as important, who will make them feel cared for? God, that's spooky. That's why Ishoki's lab has government funding to create ever more lifelike, ever human-like robots, indeed, using $5 million every year for 5 years. The project to create an autonomous humanoid, Erica, receives the largest grant from Japan's Science and Technology Agency, GIST. The Ishigo himself is a surprise. He doesn't fit this stereotype. Robots is someone with more in tune with machines than people. His first ambition is to become an oil painter. He then retains the artist's basic impulse to examine the human condition. Asked what drives his mission to build a humanoid robot, he replies, quote, "I want to understand what it is to be a human being. A mere human being. As artificial intelligence continues to develop, we will have to ask that question more and more," agrees engineer Elizabeth Croft, who supervises supervises human-robot interaction at the University of British Columbia. Okay, so I'm going to give me a Canadian accent if I read ahead. Others find Ishiko's work puzzling. Quote, "I don't understand his scientific concept exactly," says Alan Albuschrafer, director of the Institute of Robotics and Mechatronics in DLR, German's Aerospace Center. He adds, "It's like a philosophical perspective. He's at the extreme, and that provokes strange." That's change. Strange provokes change. Okay. Ichigo's work lies somewhere between the practical and the weird. Plenty of places build humanoid robots, but they're clearly mechanical representations of humanness. Ishigo actually is trying to build a human. For him, it's a way to tackle the mysteries of human mind, intelligence, and consciousness. Quote, "We can't make any analytical approach to find out what the human is," he says. "We need to a constructive approach." Oh dear. Ishigo, now 54, switched from painting to programming at university. "I was soon drawn to robotics. Quote, I saw the AI needs to have a body," he tells me at a conference in Melbourne, "because the computer needs to have its own experience." While AI has progressed in leaps and bounds in recent years, it's still enormously challenged to create robots that can maneuver themselves in our messy, ever-changing world, as opposed to the uniform conditions of the factory floor. The Google-built AlphaGo software can beat a Go champion, but robots don't stand a chance beating a team of kids at a game of football. Robot companies everywhere are grappling with the challenge. DRL has Justin, who's handy with tools. Honda has Lissimo, who can serve drinks. Rethink Robotics has Baxter, who can pass things to a co-worker and whose flat screen eyes show where his attention is. Boston Dynamics has Atlas, whose latest trick is backflips. No one, though, could mistake these robots for humans. Quote, "They are much more R2-D2 than C-3PO, Croft says. Most robot makers deliberately keep their creations robot-like, the reflect of two guiding principles. One is to steer well away from the uncanny valley, the creepy feeling you see when in almost but not quite human characteristics in computerized games and animations. The other Abu Schaffer says, as the large gap in robot versus human intelligence and autonomy should be reflected in the design, the appearance should reflect the robot's stage of evolution. Ishigo has headed in the opposite direction, plunging headlong into the uncanny valley. His Geminoid series of robots are his trademarks. The first made in 202 is the twin of his 5-year-old daughter. And replies, QI 2005 is the twin of the Tokyo newsreader. Geminoid H1 is Ichigo's twin. Geminoid F 2010 was modelled on a woman in her 20s, whose identity Ichigo's won't divulge. The idea behind making copying a real human, Ichigo says, is transfer the presence and the Sonsi Khan of the person, the robot, whatever that means. I focus on human likeness because that's the extreme goal of robotics, he tells me. In a first contact, people will be surprised but easily adapt. And these hyper-real replicas have employed the latest of silicone technology and muscle-like fine motor circuitry actuators can offer. But they are less robots than puppets. Their speech and movements controlled by someone sitting in the keyboard. One of Ichigo's key goals is for humanoids to convey emotion. Quote, we will feel emotion when that's been, when we begin to make a connection, he says, and we forget about the status of the partner. To impart expressiveness to the robots, Ichigo has turned to the master of the art, playwright director Oza Hirata, a champion of realism, quiet drama in Japanese theatre. With emotion detectors attached to his face, Hirata modelled the gestures of Ichigo wanted these humanoids to express. The collaboration led to a robot theatre project, oh god, this is weird, which has staged plays around the world in which performance computer-controlled robots fill in for human actors delivering pre-recorded lines and choreographed movements. Oh dear. God. Look, I just think you can just get a bad actor much better. The company's repertoire includes Sayonara, a play written by Hirata, where an android played by Geminoid F tries to console a girl suffering from a fatal illness until his own mechanisms go awry. In I, Worker, a robot maid loses its motivation to work. The double billed tour of the North American 2013, the Robot Theatre, also performed Frank Kafka Metamorphosis. Yes, interesting. And, my god, it goes on. Oh, talk about creepy. Anton Chekhov's Three Sisters, a planned performance of Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit for the major French arts festival in 2015 was cancelled after Sartre's estate refused permission for robot actors. Hiatra was provided the emotional X factor to many of Higashu's creations. We call him the Ozira filter, says the robot physicist. It's a codified programmable pattern based on the director's utterance and expressions. A movement of the body and hands, when the eyes, then the head, then the utterance after 0.2 seconds delay. If you apply the Ozira filter, Hugo says, our robots become so human-like. The choreography of the conversation is very consistent between people. He says so much that he describes a patent based on Ozira's movements as how to represent human likeness. God. But while some of Ishiguro's humanoids grow ever more expressive and human, others have developed in the opposite direction. I shriek in horror when Ishiguro shows me the humanoid he's developed for elderly people with dementia. It resembles a deliberate child with half arms, ending at nubs, and torso without legs. It's a bit creaky, Ishiguro admits. But it works very well. These telenoids have been used for more than 70 hospitals in Japan, as well as Denmark, Germany, and Austria. Oh, God. Oh, it's super creepy. The issue shows me a movie clip of an elderly Japanese lady hacking a telenoid and chatting to it as if she might a favorite grandchild. By being so stripped down, genderless, and ageless, demented people can use their own imaginations. They don't feel any pressure, he says. For similar reasons, he says, telenoids have also worked very well for children with autism. The more denuded variation is the Huggy-V, a soft, huggable robot that you can put a phone into. It allows you to feel the presence of a person while you're talking to them. Higashi said, he shows me another video of a room of noisy kindergarten children who immediately quiet down when their huggies start talking to, huggabees start talking to them. God, that's creepy. No doubt the ability of these stripped down humanoids to fulfill basic emotional needs also says something about what it means to be humans. I think Erica is the most beautiful of the human-like autonomous androids in the world, I hope. This is how Ego describes Erica in a video produced by The Guardian last April. To me, Erica is disconcerting. It's not that her pearly silken skin and features are all that lifelike, or that when she speaks her lips move up and down in a doll-like way. But when Erica, when Etienne, a visitor to Ichigo's lab in Osaka, talks to her, things get uncanny. Erica turns her head towards Etienne, her eyes focusing on his. "Hello there," she says. "May I ask you your name?" Etienne tells her. "It's nice to meet you, Etienne." She responds, "So," she nods, her pauses. "What country are you from?" "South Africa," Etienne tells her. "Oh, really?" he explains, shrugging his shoulders. "I've never been to South Africa, but I did love the film Chappie, which is made in South Africa. I think it raises some questions about artificial consciousness, and Chappie is very cute." I've seen this sort of thing. This is social robots. Just really doesn't impress me. Erica's ability to track Etienne during the conversation comes the courtesy of two built-in 16-channel microphone arrays, 14 infrared depth sensors, and ability to move her head 20 degrees. Wow, she's good. She cannot blink. She cannot move her arms or legs yet. Her expressive gestures, blinking, shoulder shrugs, her head turning, and his upward look of her eyes at a pensive moment have clearly been run through the Osaka Ozizara filter. She also had facial recognition capability and memory. She also she knows when she has been spoken to and when with someone before, which can refer to past conversations, which is a major thing. This is where robots have to record personal data about you, like your height and when you were, and upload it to a cloud. Of course, that's no longer secure. That robot is actually spying on you, especially when a robot interacts with miners. It's storing miners' conversation. And say, if the robot says, you say to the robot, "Look, it's too much. I'm going to kill myself." Obviously, if you haven't programmed, you know, you have your responsibility there. The evidence of the workmanship, but what is the evidence of working mind? Her architect, Dylan Glass, suggests that it is, quote, "About 2 years now I've been working with Erica to create her mind, her personality, and get all the details working." This is where we get into fuzzy territory. No one knows how to create a human mind. The fundamental consciousness and intelligence elude even definition, let alone replication. Quote, "Nobody can define human intelligence," Ichigo tells me empathetically. "That is one of our final goals, to understand what human intelligence is." Oh, God, he's in that case. He is equally adamant about that no one is close to creating human-like artificial intelligence. He describes the likes of AlphaGo as having an insect-level intelligence. Machine learning algorithms learn. Oh, God, this person is weird as. Oh, God. Winning patterns from vast data sets. AlphaGo, for instance, learned from 13 million moves by grandmasters and then from millions more playing against itself. Ichigo is unimpressed. Quote, "A human never does that. If we did, we'd get old and pass away before learning anything." The ability to learn patterns from data sets means AI can recognize voices, faces, keywords, and respond to materials in their memory. Like Siri, Erica recognizes the keywords, find matches in her memory, and answers with program responses. She is just completely, ugh. Erica is also good at faking. She can keep the conversation going even when she's off script. Respond, acknowledge, pivot is the same trick I occasionally use with talking to my grandpa, quips Croft. But there's something more to Erica, with the beginnings of something that is distinctly human. Erica has simple intentions and desires that control behavior, Ichigo says. That's the main difference with Siri. Intentions and desires sound scary. Surely the first step towards robots is taking over the world. But many robots think It's necessary, next step, quote, if you want robots to serve humans in the home, says Toby Walsh, AI expert at the University of New South Wales, we'll need them to have intentions and desires. So it is belief, desire, action. I don't know what it is. Yeah. Consider loading a dishwasher. Step-by-step instructions won't cut it, explained Abby Schiffer. A robot needs to recognize all kinds of objects under different lighting in different kitchens, retrieve them from odd positions, open a dish drawer, and finally stack the dishes in an effective fashion. Quote, we can't describe this level of equations, this kind of planning and knowledge of environment as something we assimilate throughout our lives. As something Abby Schiffer jokes, his 18-year-old son has yet to master. In robotics speaks, quote, intention and desire is what a robot needs to carry out missions. From intention and desire comes reasoning, planning and action. Yeah, this is BDI. Belief. Oh, this is belief, desires, intention, yeah. Okay, that's right, I remember reading papers on it. People think robots' intentions and desires mean they will take over the world, says Abu Schaefer. We just want them to load the dishwasher. So, what sort of intentions and desires does Erica have? Her current implementation, she wants to talk, she wants to be well recognized, and she wants to take a rest, Yusho says. Erica's mind. Erica says she is more in the mind of the beholder. He acknowledges that scientifically, no, she does not have a mind, but for visitors, she does. She has the Suzanne Cain created by her beautiful silicon face. He recounts theoretical movies and autonomous conversation. This is Turing test after all, says Walsh, referring to the computer pioneer Alan Turing's proposal that a true test of artificial intelligence is to pass it for a human conversation. Turing envisaged only text-based dialogue. Issue humanoids use their bodies to enhance the illusion. Quote, we're being fooled by machines that have almost no intelligence, Walsh notes. Japanese culture is fascinated by robots. Unlike North Americans, Croft says, the Japanese don't seem to have the same problems with the Uncali Valley. Commentators often point to Shinto to explain Japanese comfort with the mechanical people. The animist religion, which ascribes soul to inanimate objects like trees and stones, plays a strong role alongside Buddhism in Japanese culture. What's the reason we're so good for we are so good for robots, says Ishu? We don't care about flesh bodies to define a human. He hopes that people will accept Erica as a type of human. Oh God. But his ultimate goal remains to understand what it is to be human, especially his own consciousness. Oh God. His painting these days with watercolours seem to be pursuing that goal. With her palette and brush, he struggles to convey the sense of presence that objects have. How, for instance, does his consciousness perceive the presence of a chair? If I can represent my consciousness on a painting, he says, quote, I don't need to develop more robots. I can go back to art. It's seriously, and he's as old as I am. It's a pretty amazing thing. So I'm an old bugger. Okay, so this is the next article, and we're going 18 minutes. I'm going to try and go longer reading. Lasting impressions. A stretch of coastline in northwestern Australia is abounds with evidence of one of the world's most diverse dinosaur faunas. Footprints that provide a rare snapshot of life on Earth 130 million years ago, and it's almost destroyed in the name of progress. John Piccirillo explains. Okay, so that's actually quite interesting. 130 million years ago, so dinosaurs were 63 million years ago, so it's 130, that's 70 million years, that's when the dinosaurs were 300 million years ago, it's first dinosaurs. Dawn bathes the floodplain, in the amber light of pink-hued clouds decorate the distant horizon. The air is sticky with humidity. Buzzing insects have broken the silence of the night, and something enormous is on the move. The vibrations felt first, the massive footfalls of a creature up to 70 tons in a weight and 30 meters in length. I hate that when they say red in color. Across the river delta, about 10 kilometers from the coastline, is the supercontinent of Gondwana. A herd of long-necked sauropods is pacing across the sandbars between the braided river channels. Their long tails flick back and forth, leaving deep impressions on the soft mud. Travelling among them are other herbivores, stegosaurs, armoured ankylosaurs, small beaked ornithopters, moving swiftly with their hind legs. The delta itself holds little attraction for those dinosaurs, but it is a great thoroughfare between fern, clad, and cycad forests on either side. Today, the mud is just firm enough to record the paths of these dinosaurs. Before the rain can rinse those tracks away, a layer of sand wash over them, preserving the impressions for millennia, until Australia's first human inhabitants noticed shapes marked in sandstone and weave them into their dreamtime narratives. The scene is a fantasy, but something like this must have happened 130 million years ago to leave the traces of 21 kinds of dinosaurs in the rock around Wallamandi, about 50 kilometres north of Broome in northern Western Australia. The rock is part of a formation geologists call the Broome Sandstone, which outcrops along 300 kilometres of the Kimberley coast, straddling the town of Broome. The menagerie identified around Wallamandi includes gigantuan long-necked herbivorous sauropods, think Brachiosaurus, other herbivores ranging in size of kangaroos to bigger than elephants, the first ever evidence for stegosaurus in Australia, and five kinds of carnivorous theropods, think Velociraptor. At 70 sites along the 100 kilometres stretch of coast, tens of thousands of footprints offer a snapshot of a time when Australia was joined to South America, Antarctica, and the other southern landmasses that make up Gondwana. Quote, it would be have been like looking out over the Serengeti, says Steve Salisbury, a vertebrate paleontologist at the University of Queensland, who's led the documentation of at least 70 sites within this fossil trove. Quote, it's a complete dinosaur ecosystem is preserved in these rocks. The extent of the footprints was revealed in papers published in early 2017 in the memoir of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology and Peter J. They made headlines worldwide because some of the sauropod prints are big enough to fit a person. We're the largest dinosaur prints ever discovered. These footprints are also significant because they offer a window into Australia in the early Cretaceous period, a period where we have almost no fossil records because there are very few rock crests of this age in Australia. To date, almost all knowledge of Australian dinosaurs come from the east of the continent, and mainly a time slice covering only 90 to 115 million years ago. So I have to really reboot my brain on that. In fact, I went back and looked at magnetic spluttering. There's nothing really special about it. It's just a spluttering technique. It actually is the way you splutter the material. It's not how the material deposits. Outside that bracket, we know very little, Salisbury said. Phil Bell, a paleontologist at the University of New England, Armidale, New South Wales, described the diversity of species recorded by the Kimberley Sandstone as simply astounding, and it's satisfying to finally see the scientific work done and results published. Quote, we have known about these tracks for decades, he says, but we've never studied in detail, and their worth never fully appreciated. Paleontologists might be in the dark about the tracks where there were no secrets to the local of the Gulabulu people. Quote, the Gulabulu, the dinosaur tracks are part of their culture, Salisbury says. They feel a strong link with these tracks and have a deep knowledge of where they are and what's happened to them over the hundreds of generations. In 2012, Gulabulu approached Salisbury to document them. They recognise the pteropod tracks to be bird-like. Birds are, in fact, living pteropods, dinosaurs. Both the tracks and the impressions of this... Well, I don't actually know whether that's true. I'm just going through this. Okay. Both the tracks and the impressions of the cycad-like plants are woven into the Gulabulu creation mythology, forming part of a songline about the journey of being called Malara, an emu man. Malara was the lawgiver, explains Gulabulu elder Philip Rowe. He gave the country the rules we need to follow, how to behave to keep things in balance. The plant fossils are seen as impressions of males' tail feathers set for rest. The Gulabaru believe Gularabulu believe that Mala passed into the sky to settle into the Milky Way, in keeping with how Aboriginal cultures see a dark space between the stars and the Milky Way as an emu. While the traditional view of the footprints is quite different from scientific conclusions, this hasn't been a problem for the Gulabulu, such as Roe, who have a close working relationship with Salisbury and his colleagues, says team member Anthony Romlimbo. Quote, they see our different interpretations, but it's not an unwelcome one. Gulabulu are of the attitude of inclusion, a sharing knowledge belief. This is absolutely true. So this is really interesting. I had a friend who was tutoring Aboriginal kids in Redfern, and he would teach one, and then the others, just from the actual culture, said, oh, one person knows in our group, that's enough. You know, we don't, you know, there's not the idea of all the knowledge being contained in one individual. In 2011, the Gulabaru were in crisis. James Price Point, the European name for Wallandi Headland, where their footprints were found, had been selected for 3 years before by the Western Australian government for the site of an onshore liquid gas processing facility. The plan was burgeoning a $45 billion product, including the harbour, the Woodside Petroleum, backed by state government. Much of the coastline was to be developed, and the Gulabaru had little say in it. The government-backed scientists had surveyed the footprints in 2009 and 12 and reported there was little scientific interest, much to the surprise of the traditional custodians. We needed the world to see, oh my god, this has got a real thriller. To see what was at stake, Rose says. They talked to Salisbury and asked him to come and look at the tracks. Salisbury jumped at the chance. He arrived in 2011 at the heart of the campaign to save the region. Quote, these people were being told they have no right to speak on the land which they looked for thousands of years before. We knew the best thing we could do is offer the science. To this end, he spent much of the time with Roe and fellow Indigenous man Richard Hunter, learning a few of the recognisable deep spot impressions in the rock. I discovered there was a lot there, much more than had been let on. Federal Government Minister Tony Burke sent a delegation to assess the area. Salisbury team convinced the delegates of its tremendous scientific and cultural significance. A month later, Burke announced that the Greater West Kimberley, including the dinosaur tracks, will be a heritage listed. Good on your Labor Party. The LNG project proposal was finally collapsed a few years later in 2013. Then Woodside pulled down. With the protection of the National Heritage listing, Salisbury and his team got to work. For the past 5 years, scientists have returned to the site about three times a year, timing visits to coincide with the confluence of the lowest tides occurring during the dawn and dusk, when the long shadows help the eyes pick out the elusive footprints in the red-brown broom sandstone. The challenging environment, the Kimberley coast boasts the daily tides of 10 metres in the tracks are found up a half kilometre out from the shore. They are only exposed for a short period when the tide retreats, so you go out there, lay your tape measures and take your time recording them, Salisbury says. You'd think you want to ground penetrating radar or LIDAR to do it, you know, on drones. You have to be able to act fast. The tide turns really, really quickly, Rommel affirms. We often need to wade through belly-deep water. On one occasion, after working on a particular reef, we came back the next day to have the campers tell us that they've seen 3-metre crocs swimming where we'd just been a day earlier. On another occasion, a bushfire encircled researchers' beach camp. There were flames surrounding us on three sides, Roy calls. I even found a scorch mark on my tent the next morning. To record such tracks, researchers have historically made drawings and created casts. There's little time to do that with the shifting tides and circling crocodiles. Luckily, technology has come to the rescue. Here we go. Using drones, oh God, look at that, I can't believe it. Using drones developed with 3D scanners and high-resolution photography, Salisbury researchers have detailed digital record of the entire coastline. They've also used rapid-setting silicone to take impressions of prints in order to create lightweight plastic replicas back in the lab. What they are learning is fascinating, of course. 21 identified track marks, the animals that left the prints, 6 are herbivorous sauropods, 5 are carnivorous theropods, and 4 are bipedal herbivorous ornithopods, something similar to Matabarasaurus, and 6 are armoured pterophorian dinosaurs, either cichlids or lacosaurs. Quote, in South America, the US, China, there are sites with large numbers of different track types, but in Broome Sandstone passes these, Romulus says. The diversity of armored dinosaurs tracks is specifically surprising, given hitherto only the fossils of two such species have been found in Australia. The Acrosaurus mummy and the Cunabarasaurus, both located in Queensland. The carnivore tracks indicate animals ranging from the size of emus to species 6 or 7 metres in length. Some of them might have been a megatroid theropod similar to the Australophanta from Winston in Queensland, or they might have been albosaurs, a primitive carnivores with tiny arms most prevalent in South America, Africa and Madagascar. Another observation is that the cichlid prints appear to show animals walking on their hind legs for some time, definitely not the way stegosauruses appear in the illustration and toys. The handprints all of a sudden disappear and there's just big fat three-toed tracks. All we can work out is that stegosaurus made its tracks were somehow capable of getting up on its hind legs. A bit of like a pangolin, because there's no other way it could have left those tracks. The rocks don't lie. Thank goodness. Everything else does. Stegosaurus tracks in the US and Spain point to a similar behaviour. Well, good on you. So stegosauruses would bipedal? Okay. Also, to the surprise, is a scale of the 1.7 metre footprints, which have only been made by the very largest dinosaur. Perhaps something like, goes on, the huge Titanosaurus discovered in Patagonia several years ago. The peculiar sauropod that has left huge footprints estimated to have been 30 metres in length and 70 tonnes in weight is yet to be officially named or described as a species. Often footprints indicate the animals were doomed. In other cases, it can be confusing. Quote, it's like if you were down at the dam of the farm and the cattle and the kangaroos have all made a bit of a mess of the mud. Tillsbury says, quote, the sauropods have trampled each other's tracks and walked in wiggly lines, making it really hard to make sense of them. Stupid dinosaurs. Dumb dinosaurs. In one case, though, Romulus says, quote, we knew exactly where it was going and what it was doing. Okay, it must have been shopping. I was told scientists it was slipping and struggling to get a grip on the mud as it moved down the slope. Its footprints are dragging from here and there. It was sliding down, slipping, and sometimes making double steps. Okay, what's doing? Because trace fossils, such as footprints, burrows, and nests, are products of behaviour, they differ and they offer special insights in the animals' lives many years ago, says Anthony Martin, an expert. So we were going to find out what he was doing, it's just how they were doing it. Okay. Expert on footprints and other trace fossils at Emory University, Atlanta, Georgia. Quote, footprints, for example, can inform us where the animal is walking, running, stopping, changing direction, swimming, or reacting to another animal. And they are normally in the same place where the dinosaurs made them. Like a lake, shore, stream bank. In contrast, bones can only tell us so much about the behaviour, as they are often moved far away from the original environment. So that's actually quite a good thing, that bones can actually wash down. While the 21 track markers identified so far have been determined from the 25-kilometre stretch of coast around Walter Danny, the scientists have been studying footprints along the 100-kilometre stretch. There are most certainly going to be new animals announced among the track makers from a wider area. So far, research has involved documenting the footprints and identifying the kind of numbers of animals that created them, but much work lies ahead. We'd like to understand the behaviour of these track makers, Romulus said. Did they move in herds? Were they solitary? Okay, well, it can't be either both. Why were there some types of dinosaurs, such as carnivores, more prevalent in some areas than others? Okay. To answer that question, Salisbury and his team must continue to return, thank you for more grant money, to collect more data. It's an environment that's changing all the time. Some areas are getting buried in sand, and others are being exposed as the sand moves, Salisbury says. I don't think we've covered all of it, not by a long shot. One question yet to be definitively answered is why there are no fossil bones. The scientists suspect the environment was too acidic to preserve bones, and as far as they can determine, the footprints were left in a very narrow time window, perhaps as little as a few days or a week. They are also very easy to have been obliterated forever with a few days' work from a bulldozer. Quote, thankfully, we can talk about this area having the world's most diverse dinosaur track fauna and not about being an LNG precinct, Silsby says. Safeguarding the other tracks will help inform the canon of scientific knowledge just as they have informed the Dreamtime for many millennia. And that's a really beautiful way that John Pickerel, you're almost getting up to Elizabeth Finkel's standard there. Okay, 35. I've got to really push myself. Cracks in the universe. Once the theoretical notion of gravity waves is now the stuff of textbooks, could cosmic strings be next? Kathy O'Connell explores the possibilities of... Good God. Our universe exploded into being, expanded from a fantastic speed, expand and cool, perhaps too quickly, according to some physicists. Rapid cooling may have cracked the fabric of the universe. These hairline fractures may simply thread through space-time. Dubbed cosmic strings, mathematical models see them as invisible threads of pure energy, thinner than an atom, but light-years long. A huge amount of energy is contained that makes them extremely heavy. A few centimeters of cosmic string may weigh as much as Mount Everest. Proponents of cosmic strings like Thibault D'Amour, a theoretical physicist at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Paris, are persuaded by the maths that keeps predicting their existence. Quote, the fact strings come all the time makes me confident they exist. However, as time capsules of the early universe, cosmic strings should retain fantastic energies, more than a billion times greater than released by smashing particles at the Large Hadron Collider, says Ken Olam, a theoretical physicist at Tufts University of Boston, who contemplated cosmic strings for 20 years. You can build an accelerator to test physics at that scale. You can't build one. Neither can any other astronomical instrument detect the vanishing thin intergalactic filaments. For some physicists, the theory that can't be tested is not worth pursuing. It places cosmic strings in the same category as string theory. The controversial namesake at the other extreme end of the size scale. String theory involves vibrating strings tinier than any subatomic particle as a building block of the universe. For Matthew Bowles, the astrophysicist at Swinburne University of Technology at Melbourne, cosmic strings are, quote, a mathematical curiosity, or worse, an exotic fantasy. All that may be about to change. The nascent era of gravitational waves astronomy, just 2 years old, may finally deliver a tool to test the existence of cosmic strings. We can't see them, but gravitational wave detectors might be able to hear them, the thumps and snaps created as they whip through space. You might wonder how the emptiness of space could be cracked. It helps to picture the universe through the eyes of quantum field theorists. Neo in The Matrix was close. He saw the world as a diaphanous fabric of greenish ones and zeros. Quantum field theorists see the universe as a fabric of all-pervading fields. Fields fill the space like fluid, and what we call particles are ripples in the fluid. That's a really nice way of putting it. A photon is a ripple in the electromagnetic field, which we experience as light. An electron is a ripple in the electron field. A Higgs boson is a ripple in the Higgs field, and so on. There's nothing except fields is the way. British theorist Tom Kibble, who died in June 2016, thank you, came up with the idea of cosmic strings in 76. He was musing about the first and second after the Big Bang, when the universe underwent rapid expansion and cooled rapidly. This, he suggested, caused a phase change in the quantum fields, like the freezing, like water freezing to ice. In the box of ice, some regions freeze with their crystals in different orientations, rather like tiles being laid simultaneously at different ends of a room. Where they meet, they don't fit together smoothly, resulting in a crack. Like Kibble's surmise that quantum phase changes in the early universe could have caused the fields to align in different orientations, again causing cracks, cosmic strings. Gee, I'm really running out of power now. Some of Kibble's past predictions have paid off. He independently predicted the existence of fundamental particles that imparts mass to others, also known as the Higgs boson. He discovered won the 2012 Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize was awarded for that. Cosmic strings, however, were particularly problematic to put to rest. They could only appear at the edges of vast regions about as big as the observable universe. That's why, in Kibble's original 1976 scheme, he wrote that, quote, looking for cosmic strings directly would be pointless. There the story of cosmic strings might have ended, but for the remarkable calculation of Ukrainian physicist Alexander Vilkyankin about 5 years later. By early 1980s, most cosmologists accepted the Big Bang Theory. Oh dear. The idea that the universe had evolved from the expansion of a uniformly hot, dense state, but the idea that had one big problem. The lumpy distribution of galaxies. The simple theory of galaxy formation holds that they are formed from clouds of hydrogen and condensed under the pull of gravity. That, however, should yield evenly spaced galaxies. Furthermore, the earliest galaxies formed too quickly to be explained by the process. So how did we get the lumpy universe? Rankin was thinking about the problem when he picked up the aside from Kibble's 76 paper. When the cosmic string wriggling the void itself, it would chop itself into constrained loops. The loops would be light year size hula hoops in space and enormously heavy. Beacon ran the numbers and realized the numbers of cosmic loops would be existed in the early universe. It was curiously close to the number of galaxies. Perhaps, he reasons, a cosmic loop could be a young galaxy, much like a grain of sand feeds a pearl. The idea caused excitement among physicists. Stephen Hawking wrote papers on how hoops might collapse to form black holes. Others got interested in how they bent and twisted space. Some even worked out how cosmic strings might be detected. If the hoops were abundant in the early universe, they could have been left a pattern of radiation behind the Big Bang, the so-called microwave background. Okay, I might be interested in this. But this is actually interesting. This is the gravitational wave detectors. Okay. Okay. I'll just read this. Gravitational wave detectors are our best hope for listening for cracks and hums of the cosmic strings. They are tuned to deliver different frequency. Leo and Virgo might hear the high-pitched cracks, pulses, timing arrays. Pulsar timing arrays could hear the less sub-bass rumblings, and Lisa can fill in the gaps, whatever that means. In November 1989, the Cosmic Background Explorer COBE satellite was launched. It's pretty amazing, and now that's, who knows what it is. We knew YMAP and COBE. A US $140 million experiment to map the cosmic background radiation. But when the data was unveiled in 1992, the cosmic showed no hint of cosmic strings. Instead, it favored the idea galaxies had seeded around tiny quantum fluctuations that had been imprinted when the universe grew to less than the size of an atom. Quote, that did cause people to lose some enthusiasm for cosmic strings, admits Xavier Siemens, a theoretical physicist at the University of Milwaukee, but they were not ruled out. Meanwhile, Kibble's strings were popping up in other fields of physics. In 1996, two papers in the same issue of Nature described experiments where liquid helium modelled the early universe had been rapidly cool. String-like defects appeared. Other stringish flaws were found during the phase changes to liquid crystals, subsequent conductors. Exotic materials whose properties also fit Kibble's equations. Quote, in fact, one might say, defects of ordering processes of the type Kibble discovered have been found and studied almost everywhere except in the universe, writes physicist Neil Tork of Canada's Perimeter Institute in his 2013 book Symmetry of Fundamental Physics, Symmetry and Fundamental Physics. The cosmic string idea also cropped up in the physics of very small. In 2003, one symmetric systematic review published by Physical Review D concluded that almost all theories of supersymmetry, the idea of all fundamental particles, have as yet unseen partners, predict cosmic strings to be one form of another. Meanwhile, Olam and others have run computer simulations showing that if the predictions hold true, there should be at least a billion cosmic string loops sprinkled throughout the observable universe, which is really nothing. You know. What's missing is the real observations, but how could you detect something thinner than an atom that was as long as the galaxy and invisible to boot? Enter gravitational waves. In September 2015, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGON, detected gravitational waves reverberating from colliding black holes. That added a new dimension to astronomers' ability to scan the universe. Quote, after LIGO's discovery, Dimor says, I immediately thought, aha, now it would be good if cosmic strings were detected. Cosmic strings can't be seen, but they might be heard. Gravitational waves are ripples in space-time generated by massive objects moving extremely fast, like a pair of inspiring black holes or neutron stars, or the writhing cosmic string. What happens is like a whip, explains Damore, who worked out the idea with Jenkins in 2000. The crack of the bullwhip is actually a sonic boom caused by the part of its tail that moves faster than the speed of sound. Likewise, cosmic strings wiggles and bounces. Some parts are whipped up to the speed of light and emit bursts of gravitational waves. The two physicists have calculated that such a burst might be detected by LIGO. From 2005 to 2010, LIGO listened but heard. Okay, so, yeah. So, LIGO listened, heard, but no whip cracks. Since 2015, Advanced LIGO, an upgraded version of which is four times more sensitive, continued its vigil. One difficulty is detecting cracks would only be emitted in a particular direction. Like the beam of a flashlight, LIGO would have to be in the right path of the beam. That's why our best hope for detecting cosmic strings is probably not from cracks, but from their rotations. As a loop of cosmic strings spins like a hula hoop, it would emit gravitational waves, one wave for each turn of the loop. Since the hoops could have a circumference of light years, it would be decades to finish a single spin. In other words, the cosmic hula hoop would generate gravitational waves at extremely low frequency, way too low for LIGO to detect. You need an entirely different kind of gravitational wave detector. Luckily, we have one awaiting the winds. The Pulsar Timing Array is a gravitational wave detector the size of the galaxy. Pulsars are swimming neutron stars, collapsed cores, and exploded stars, emitting intense beams of light that appear to blink on and off at the precision rivaling atomic clocks. The North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, NanoGrav, has been obsessively timing dozens of pulsars for a decade. Any deviations from the norm could indicate that passing gravitational waves have stretched or squeezed the space-time between us and the pulsar, causing a slight lag or advance in time. We're about to open a new window on gravitational waves at low frequencies, says Siemens, who's the director of the NanoGrav. So that's really interesting. I didn't know anything about that, about gravitational waves. To keep tabs on pulsars across the sky, NanoGrav is linked with two other pulsar timing arrays, one using radio telescopes across Europe and the other based in the Parkes Observatory in New South Wales. So far, the searchers have drawn a blank, as Siemens and Olam announced last September. In physics, when you don't find something, it's not a failure, Olam says. It's a success of a different kind because it tells us something new about the universe, which is exactly true. So, can I say, not being able to get back to work, you know, having that blocked, that's a new thing. I have to solve that problem. There is a no-show of cosmic strings. How am I going? 48 minutes. My God, that's really tiring, folks. No show of cosmic strings at a certain energies can be clearly used to rule out some theories of supersymmetry. The next level up, the search for cosmic strings, is perhaps our only hope for a definitive answer. We'll come online with the LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, a space-based gravitational wave detector due to be launched in 2034. Hopefully I'm alive for that. How old? I'll be pretty old by then. 30. 60, I'll be 70, 71, oh God, which will listen to the frequency band at high-pitched chirps caught by, between high-pitched chirps by LIGO, and sub-bass murmurs which the pulses timing to a rate of change. Even if the evidence continues to come up negative, some physicists are unlikely to go and let go of cosmic strings, Siemens. So the strings might have been formed with too low an energy to give off any signals detectable in the near future. Another possibility is that ancient cosmic strings radiated away their energy and faded to nothingness too quickly after the Big Bang to have left a lasting impression. For now, cosmic strings sit on the shelf alongside other beautiful ideas that could compete for our understanding of the universe but lack empirical support. Quote, "This is the beauty and the danger of physics," Dermore says. "Something exists and we can never see." I think it's nature. And I've reached 50 minutes. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll just load this up now. Thanks a lot. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.